a way to kind of tar his rivals and his opponents in that moment. What we know now, based on the latest cache of documents, is that far from keeping arm's distance, he was actually in semi-regular contact with Epstein and made very clear plans to come and visit him on his island to party, as he put it in the emails. So the distance that was claimed to be there was actually nothing of this sort, and he's quite clearly as enmeshed in this toxic Epstein network as the very people he was criticizing.
Quinn Slobodian, we're going to talk to you much more about your book when it comes out in the next months, Muskism, A Guide for the Perplexed. Quinn Slobodian is professor of international history at Boston University. We thank you so much for being with us. On Monday, February 23rd, Democracy Now! Is celebrating our 30th anniversary at Riverside Church in New York. Nermeen and I, as well as Juan Gonzalez, who's flying in from Chicago, will be there with hopefully you. Guests will include Angela Davis, Naomi Klein, the Nobel Prize-winning Maria Ressa, the great Michael Stipe, and the jazz legend Wynton Marsalis, Masaba Butoha, hooray for the riffraff, and so many more. You can go to democracynow.org for more information and tickets. That's democracynow.org. I can't wait to see you there, Nermeen.
Me too.
And a very happy 15th birthday to one Arthur Alcoff. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh for another edition of Democracy Now!
You are tuned in to listener-supported community radio, KBOO Portland.
Independent media is now more important than ever. And we want to know how KBOO Community Radio can best serve you. KBOO's Board of Directors invites you to a community meeting on Saturday, February 21st at 11:30 a.m. at the Clinton Street Theater and online via public video conference. This is your opportunity to share feedback, offer ideas, and help guide the station's direction. The meeting will be followed by a social hour. That's KBOO Community Radio's community meeting on Saturday, February 21st at 11:30 a.m. at the Clinton Street Theater. For more information, visit kboo.fm/community26.
Support for KBOO comes from its members and from Jay Hocken Productions, presenting a screening of Sumud, a doctor's report on genocide and survival in Gaza, at Cinema 21 on Sunday, February 8th. The screening will be followed by a panel discussion. Tickets and info at cinema21.com.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, Oregon joins a class action lawsuit trying to stop warrantless arrests by ICE. A special report from our Josh Salem. The state's seeing a rise in people needing basic nutrition. And later, a leading voice on the history of African American women is coming to Portland. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, February 5th, 2026. I'm Annette Newell. Thanks so much for joining us tonight. Oregon just joined two other United States venues that are restricting warrantless arrests by ICE unless agents believe and document that there's a significant flight risk. As KBOO's Josh Salem reports, this is now officially part of a class action lawsuit.
In a brand new decision, a federal judge preliminarily ruled U.S. immigration agents in Oregon must stop arresting people without warrants unless there's a likelihood of escape. U.S. District Judge Mustafa Kasubi just issued his preliminary injunction in a proposed class action lawsuit targeting the Department of Homeland Security's practice of arresting immigrants they happen to come across while conducting aggressive enforcement operations. The ruling came at the end of a day-long hearing in federal court in Portland. Critics have described that practice as arrest first, justify later. Similar actions, like immigration agents entering private property with only an administrative warrant and not a warrant issued by a court, had already drawn concern from civil rights groups. In a memo last week, Todd Lyons, the acting head of ICE, did say agents should not make an arrest without an administrative arrest warrant issued by a supervisor unless they develop probable cause to believe the person is likely to escape from the scene. But the judge heard evidence that agents in Oregon have been arresting people in immigration sweeps without such warrants, or without determining escape was likely. Kasubi said the actions of agents in Oregon, including drawing guns on people while detaining them for civil immigration violations, have been, quote, violent and brutal. And he was concerned about the administration denying due process to victims of raids. He added, quote, due process calls for those who have great power to exercise great restraint. That is the bedrock of a democratic republic founded on this great constitution. I think we're losing that, end quote. The judge noted there is clear evidence of potential future harm, saying the material documenting broad-reaching and sweeping approaches was overwhelming. He said he doesn't believe his injunction will impede immigration enforcement, but rather will improve it. He also ordered federal immigration officers to document in narrative form all warrantless arrests made in Oregon, and what information officers used to support their finding that someone was likely to escape before they could obtain a warrant. Assistant U.S. Attorney Thomas Ratcliffe asked the judge not to take the drastic step of issuing an injunction. He pointed to that memo from ICE Director Todd M. Lyons that outlined requirements and guidance for all ICE officers, arguing it would prevent any future harm, because it makes clear to federal immigration officers that they must follow the law. The nonprofit law firm Innovation Law Lab brought the lawsuit, which was granted class action status. With the order, Oregon joins Washington, D.C. and Colorado in restricting the practice. For KBOO News, I'm Josh Salem.
This Saturday, the immigrant rights organization Portland Contra Las Deportaciones, or PDXCD, plans a protest at Mayor Keith Wilson's home to demand that he take immediate action to revoke the permit for Portland's ICE facility. Members say it's been a year of a Trump presidency and immigrants and citizens alike in Portland terrorized throughout the year by ICE, including people harassed by masked ICE personnel at bus stops, being sprayed with chemical weapons in neighborhoods, and the South Waterfront neighborhood having more than 8 months of gassing of carcinogenic substances from DHS out of the Portland ICE facility, so bad that a school was forced to relocate. A land use violation was issued to the owner of the Portland ICE facility in September of 2025, and the city still caught up in negotiations to make the violation stick. Portland police are investigating and answering some questions about a shooting involving officers in which a suspect was killed in a Pearl District Apartment building this morning. Here's Kevin Allen, the public information officer for the Portland Police.
This investigation is an officer-involved shooting where the subject is deceased and all officers are okay. So this investigation actually began last Saturday on January 31st at about 1:04 p.m. when Central Precinct officers responded to a report of a threat with a weapon at the Safeway at the 1400 block of Northwest Lovejoy. When the officers responded and investigated, they found that a suspect had approached the security officers at the Safeway, produced a handgun, and pulled the trigger. The handgun did not fire. A scuffle ensued, and during the scuffle, the security officers pulled a backpack off of the suspect. The suspect ran from the scene. Officers made a very lengthy investigation and a search for that suspect in the neighborhood and were trying to find him. They were not successful that day at finding him. However, when they searched the backpack, they found that there was a shotgun in the backpack that was loaded, which certainly increased the level of concern about the danger to the community that this suspect posed. So the case was forwarded over to the Enhanced Community Safety Team, and they utilized their investigative techniques over the course of days to determine who the suspect is and where he is at. They were able to obtain an arrest warrant for that suspect, who lives in the 1600 block of Northwest 14th Avenue. They brought in the Specialty Emergency Reaction Team and the Crisis Negotiation Teams that go out to incidents like this and serve dangerous search warrants on armed individuals. That service of the warrant was planned this morning, just after 5 o'clock in the morning. The tactical crews knocked on the door, announced themselves. They used explosive breaching tools to try to breach the door and a wall into the apartment. They attempted communication with the suspect, basically calling him out, saying, you need to come outside. This is the Portland police. The suspect did not communicate with them, and eventually there was a need to deploy gas into the apartment in order to prompt him to come out. Because this is an apartment, there's a lot of people that live there. Officers took the time to evacuate the entire 10th floor to make sure that everyone that is in that area was safe from the gas deployment. That was effective, and the suspect came out. There were shots fired, and the suspect is deceased.
And here's more about the case from Portland Police Chief Bob Day.
We're always saddened at the loss of life, and we should never lose sight of the fact that our primary responsibility in public safety is the preservation of life and the sanctity of life. And events like this have a tremendous impact, not only on this individual and his family and his community, but also on the officers involved, the first responders, the medical personnel, the investigators, the broader Portland community, the people in the apartment complex, et cetera. I'm particularly grateful that our officers are safe. Their professionalism, their expertise, our special emergency reaction team and our crisis negotiation team are always called upon in these highly critical, high-risk situations. It really highlights the need for continue to have a well-funded, well-resourced, well-equipped Portland Police Department, that the organization is still feeling very fragile. The events of a couple of weeks ago where a couple of our officers were shot, this obviously is a high intensity situation. We'll have the independent police review. We will partner with our East County Major Crimes Team, the District Attorney's Office, our own Professional Standards Division, and our training division. And the community can be assured that there will be many eyes on this. There has been no conclusion reached on the facts or the justification of the officer's actions, as we will continue to let the investigation play out. But very proud and grateful that our officers are safe. It's really been a trying couple of several months for the police bureau, whether it be managing the events, the public order events, or the activities in the South Waterfront, maintaining our commitment to not participate in immigration enforcement, to also some of the violence that we're seeing directed towards our officers, and ongoing efforts to reduce crime and the fear of crime in the city of Portland.
Advocates fighting hunger in Oregon are calling for lawmakers to invest in SNAP this session, as new data shows record-breaking food insecurity in the state. Isabel Charlet reports.
New data shows rates of hunger in Oregon and Southwest Washington are at record levels, with 1 in 7 adults and 1 in 6 children in the state facing food insecurity. The data collected by Oregon Food Bank shows that visits to food pantries have grown by more than 50% in the last 2 years. The food bank's president, Andrea Williams, gave her annual State of Hunger address today in Salem, where she presented the new data. She says the state has an opportunity this session to make critical investments so that Oregonians can keep their SNAP benefits.
We all remember what it was like last October, November, when SNAP was delayed, when over 700,000 Oregonians suddenly didn't have money on their EBT card to go to the grocery store, and what a crisis and catastrophe that was.
She says the Food for All Oregonians Coalition is advocating for the state to provide the Department of Human Services with the funding it needs to upgrade its technology, hire more staff, and expand its capacity to maintain SNAP. Williams says Oregon families are being squeezed by rising food prices, as well as recent cuts to federal benefits after Congress passed its budget reconciliation bill last July. She says the coalition is also calling on the state to help the estimated 3,000 refugees, asylees, and other immigrants living here legally who already lost their food benefits entirely because of that law. She explains while food banks are helpful, they aren't a stand-in for SNAP.
For every one meal that we provide, SNAP provides 7. So when you think about that scale, food banks alone cannot replace the scale of a government-wide program.
Data from the USDA shows that during economic downturns, every dollar spent from SNAP generates $1.50 in new spending, helping stabilize the economy. I'm Isabel Charlet, Oregon News Service.
The Trump administration has aggressively pursued changes to public land management policies. But for the moment, the White House is backing down on immigration amid widespread backlash. And the Supreme Court lets a blue-tinted California congressional map go ahead. For some of the stories impacting our democracy, here's today's edition of 2026 Talks.
The Trump administration has really cut the public out of public land by limiting the amount of work that companies need to do to get a permit and limiting the opportunities for public participation in permitting.
Kate Grotzinger with the Center for Western Priorities says their analysis finds the administration has implemented roughly 4/5 of the public lands agenda in Project 2025, despite President Donald Trump publicly disavowing it during the campaign. The White House argues faster permitting boosts energy production, jobs, and tax revenue. The center says environmental review and public input are being gutted while congressional Republicans are moving to roll back federal land protections across western states. After weeks of protests and two killings by federal agents, the administration is withdrawing about a quarter of the immigration officers from the Twin Cities. Border czar Tom Homan says the shift reflects better coordination with local authorities, not a retreat.
This is smarter enforcement, not less enforcement. President Trump fully intends to achieve mass deportations during this administration, and immigration enforcement actions will continue every day throughout this country.
Negotiations continue in Congress over possible ICE reforms. In the meantime, Maryland legislators are pushing to limit local law enforcement cooperation with the agency, arguing those partnerships erode public safety. And in Arkansas, teacher groups are training educators on how to respond if immigration agents come to a school. They say state officials have been offering little guidance. Lawmakers in Indiana are moving forward on expanding that cooperation. A bill headed to the House floor would require schools, colleges, and local governments to fulfill detention requests and would let the state attorney general sue businesses that hire undocumented migrants. But Monday, hundreds of high school students blocked streets in central Indiana, protesting the immigration sweeps, and civil rights activist and attorney Chip Pitts says the violent raids are violating the Constitution.
They use brutality and really aggressive tactics, breaking windows without having a probable cause of individualized fact-based suspicion as required by the Fourth Amendment, and then hauling pregnant women out. And they've done this to hundreds of U.S. citizens.
The Supreme Court says California can use its new congressional map for the midterms, ruling that it was not based on race and partisan gerrymandering is legal. The redistricting was pushed by Democrats to offset a similar Republican-led effort in Texas. Fulton County, Georgia has asked a federal court to mandate the return of hundreds of boxes of 2020 ballots and other election materials seized during an FBI raid. The county is arguing the seizure raises national concerns about ballot custody, transparency, and how election records are handled after votes are cast. I'm Farah Siddiqui for Pacifica Network.
After a storm's devastation, villagers in Kipnuk weigh whether they should return or relocate. A Navajo County birth certificate program sees a spike due to ICE fears. And Senators Cortez Mastro and Rounds introduce a bill that would elevate the IHS director. Here's Antonia Gonzalez with today's edition of National Native News.
The Alaska Native village of Kipnuk is at a crossroads. A powerful storm last fall destroyed homes, contaminated water, and left residents with a critical decision: rebuild in the same spot or move to higher ground. As Ayona Niden with the Alaska Desk reports, the conversation is just getting started.
Kipnuk resident Raina Paul fights back tears as she talks about how the remnants of Typhoon Halon ravaged her village and why relocating is so important for the next generation.
We want them to have a livable life too.
She shared her thoughts at a recent meeting in Anchorage where more than 50 Kipnuk residents discussed the future of their community. Village Council President Daniel Paul says it will be up to the residents to decide.
I had many calls from our tribe members. Half of them want to stay, half want to go.
Kipnuk is about 4 miles inland from the Bering Sea coast and was once home to about 700 people. Nearly everyone evacuated after the October storms. Paul says about 100 residents are back now, working to rebuild. But there is a lot to do. The storm demolished about 150 homes, wiped out vital infrastructure, and left lands and water contaminated. During the meeting, residents spoke predominantly in Yupik, asking what relocation could look like. They asked about how to choose a new site and secure land ownership. And they pondered what it would take to set up critical infrastructure at the new place. Village Council Vice President Chris Alexei says that would include a school, airport, and health clinic.
This isn't going to be an easy process to do, but we have to do that.
Village officials say the relocation process can take years. Kipnuk Elder David Carl says he supports relocating.
We're not thinking about ourselves, who we are now. We just want to fight for our upcoming generations.
But for Daniel Paul, Kipnuk is home.
I was raised there and I'll stay there.
Paul says the meeting was just the first step in the relocation discussion, and residents have a lot of factors to weigh. But Kipnuk leaders also feel a sense of urgency. Paul says the village expects only one substantial influx of federal funding. To make the best use of it, He says they need to decide soon whether they want to stay or move. In Anchorage, I am Alona Naiden.
For decades, public health officials in Navajo County, Arizona, have been helping tribal members and elders who were not born inside a hospital with obtaining birth certificates. As KJZZ's Gabriel Pietrazio reports, they've seen a spike in applicants following reports of Native people getting caught up in ICE crackdowns nationwide.
Last year, 305 residents applied for delayed birth certificates across Navajo County, two-thirds of which covers tribal lands belonging to Navajos, Hopis, and White Mountain Apaches. Violet Redbird Nez, who is Kiowa and Diné, is a vital records specialist with County Public Health. She treks the Kanta quarterly to help residents get documented, and for the last 3 months, Redbird Nez says there's an uptick.
They're worried that they might get deported.
There were 22 applicants last month alone. Once the paperwork is filled out, it typically takes 6 weeks.
It is so endearing to know that they came by to say, hey, thank you for helping me get my birth registered. I'm legal now, is what they say.
For National Native News, I'm Gabriel Pietrazio.
This week, U.S. Senators Catherine Cortez Masto and Mike Rounds introduced the Stronger Engagement for Indian Health Needs Act. The legislation elevates the role of the Indian Health Service Director to Assistant Secretary for Indian Health within the Department of Health and Human Services. Senators say elevating the position would give IHS greater authority to address the healthcare needs of Native communities. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
Each year for the past 25 years, the Oregon Historical Society has welcomed some of the nation's top historians and authors to come to Portland for the Mark O. Hatfield Lecture Series. Dr. Keisha Blaine will appear at the series on February 17th. The Brown University professor researches and writes about the dynamics of race, gender, and politics in both national and global perspectives. Blaine's latest book is entitled Without Fear, Black Women and the Making of Human Rights. I talked to Dr. Blaine about how throughout American history, Black women made human rights their own.
Several people who know my work have been recommending me to the Oregon Historical Society. That's certainly my thought. Over the years, I've had multiple people say to me, oh, we'd love for you to come speak there. Your work would be great to be featured there. And I was thrilled to finally have an invitation this year.
And your scholarly work and your books have focused so much on the achievements of Black women in history. And in a nutshell, why is that so important for these stories to be told when many times they haven't been told in our history?
Yes, I think it's important to center Black women's history because in so many ways it helps us understand a number of foundational themes in American history and certainly in American life and culture. I'm thinking about concepts such as power and privilege or domination as just broad ideas that we can certainly grapple with when we look at the experiences and ideas of a group of people who have had to experience multiple forms of oppression, one because they are women and because they are Black, living in a country that has always been both racist, certainly when we think about laws and policies, that is certainly true, as well as sexist in a myriad of ways. So when we focus on Black women, we really do get a sense of how a marginalized group not only faced a myriad of challenges, but what I find most important in the story is how they responded to the resistance that they faced, how they came up with strategies. They devised solutions to many of the problems that we have faced in American society and even on a global level.
And I know that you focused on, for example, Fannie Lou Hamer and some of the more well-known big name people, but there's also a lot of stories about some of the women we didn't know about. And why was that important to find out somebody who might have been known because she had skills as a business person or entrepreneurship, but was also working globally to try to help with civil rights?
I think it's important to center an array of individuals from diverse backgrounds. And that's one of the reasons why when I write these books, I certainly talk about individuals who are well-known, those who might be educators, writers, where we certainly have fairly easy access to materials that they might have left behind. And then I also focus on individuals who did not leave much of a paper trail. But I believe it's important to center their voices too, to send a broader message that anyone can make a difference, quite frankly. It's important, of course, to always grapple with the contributions of those who we recognize as prominent leaders in our society, those who hold official positions. That's certainly important. I also think it's important to think about those who don't have those kinds of opportunities, but who come up with strategies, especially at the grassroots level, to initiate change within their communities. And at times, they're able to do so at a national level or even at an international level. Even though many people are unaware of their contributions, I think it sends a broader message to all of us about our own potential as those who can, in fact, shape history, even when we don't necessarily have the prominence or the visibility. And so my work has been very intentional about centering the voices of individuals who are generally absent. That is painstaking work, as you can imagine. I spent a lot of time digging. I spent a lot of time trying to piece together stories of individuals who might have been working poor or working class activists or intellectuals who did not necessarily have formal education, but was certainly had a lot of knowledge and a lot of ideas to offer.
What did you think about the campaign of Kamala Harris and how we're going to be looking back at that through a historical lens as the first African-American woman of color candidate for the presidency?
I think when we look back at Harris's run for presidency, there will be a lot of discussions about how she was treated, how she was covered in the media. I mentioned earlier the importance of studying Black women because we get this sense of how a marginalized group responds to or grapples with multiple forms of oppression. And in a way, when you look at Harris's experience, all of that comes to the surface. It's not that we don't see individuals challenging candidates or critiquing candidates. That's a given. But if we pay attention to what people had to say about her, the kinds of critiques, the focus on her laughter as opposed to her ideas, that is reflective of a broader history of how Black women are often not taken seriously as intellectuals, as political thinkers, and attention paid to one's outfit, for example, as opposed to one's policy agenda. And I think her campaign reveals just how much work we have left to do as a nation. And that's particularly important to reflect on now, 2026, with the 250th commemoration of the American Revolution and the signing of the Declaration of Independence. What does it mean that still we have not witnessed the election of a Black woman as president, not even a woman as president? So I think people will reflect on her experiences as a reminder that the fight for both civil and human rights, that these fights are far from over. We have certainly made progress, but we have a long way to go.
One of the ideas that struck me is you mentioned the words without fear and how that is so important right now, especially in this political moment with the DEI backlash and people, I guess, being challenged more and more about their ideas, and especially when it comes to speaking out about civil rights and just the clashes that we've seen in Minneapolis. Here in Portland, we've had protest after protest for the rights of immigrants and people of color. And I just think that that idea of without fear, being unafraid, why is that so important right now?
It is so important because one of the things that really stands out to me in studying Black women's lives and focusing on their ideas is that there's really never a time in U.S. or global history where Black women organizers or activists did the work without a sense of fear and anxiety. So what's interesting is even in referencing the phrase without fear, it comes out of a speech that Mary McLeod Bethune is giving in 1944 to Black women. She's speaking to Black women at this workshop, and she's telling them that it's so important for them to do this work of human rights. It's important to forge alliances across national borders and to push for expanded rights for not just Black people, but all marginalized groups across the globe. And I mentioned 1944. You think about the context of World War II, the fight to end colonialism as just one example. And I think she emphasized this particular point because she knew that there would be many people in the room who simply wanted to be part of this effort, but they were too afraid, afraid of the reprisals, afraid of what would happen to them, to their families, if they were involved in this movement for change. And I think by calling it out, she was trying to suggest to them that it is, in fact, a human response to feel fear. It's not something that we should be ashamed of. But the key is that even when you feel it, you don't let it dictate your actions. So you may feel it, but you have to push beyond it because the work you are setting out to do is so important that you can't allow the feeling to hold you back. And so I love the phrase without fear, because it's not saying that fear doesn't exist. It's simply saying that it should not be the barrier, that you can feel it, but you have to move beyond it when you're looking at the larger picture here, which is to bring about meaningful change for all people. So we need that message today. There are so many reasons to feel fearful with everything that's going on across the nation and the globe.
Let's talk for a moment and zero in on what your message is going to be to the audience in Oregon when you come here. And tell me about your talk, what you're planning to focus on.
I'm planning to talk about Black women and the struggle for human rights in U.S. history, drawing on the original research that I've done to produce my latest book.
Do you think that there is a quelling of voices right now going on because of the anti-DEI push of the current administration, and especially when it comes to academia and some universities have capitulated and given into this? And is there a danger of losing a lot of knowledge that we've accumulated about America's real history?
Yes, unfortunately, I have witnessed far too many academics who study similar topics. I've seen them silenced. I've seen job opportunities simply disappear because searches are canceled and someone's afraid to move forward with plans to hire a professor who might teach courses on Black people or any other marginalized group in this country.
Thanks for joining us here on the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, February 5th, 2026.
This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips.